Hello and welcome to Intrepid Heroes Presents, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games. I'm John Godek, and with me today is Owen Casey Stevens. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, it's awesome to finally get you. So many other people have talked about you. I've been kind of itching to get you on the podcast here. So Owen is an RPG design and development luminary, having been the Starfinder design lead for Paizo, having worked for on the Star Wars role-playing game Saga Edition, the Black Company RPG, the Wheel of Time RPG, the Thieves World RPG, and four editions of Dungeons & Dragons. He's the owner and publisher of Rogue Genius Games, as well as a developer for Green Ronin Publishing and Wright Publishing, and he recently joined the staff at No Direction Beyond. So, Owen, so many people I've talked to have mentioned how you have inspired them in their own RPG writing and development journeys. Can you tell us a little bit about your own journey in the gaming industry?
Sure. So I have this really weird case that I was literally developing RPGs before I ever played one. In 1982, my parents went to Europe and made the very reasonable decision to not take me or my sister with them, which at the time I was annoyed by. As an adult, I totally understand. And so they left me with my uncle for the summer, and he was the sort of person that had a flight simulator on an Apple IIe and had a bunch of construction toys that you could make actual working models for. And he had a second edition first edition hardback D&D Dungeon Master's Guide. And the very look of that book just fascinated me. And he saw me looking at it and trying to read it. And he said, "Hey, if you can figure that game out, I'll happily play a game with you. I just don't know how the game plays." So I did not have and could not find anywhere nearby a player's handbook. But I really wanted to play this game. So I used the information in the Dungeon Master's Guide to figure out what information we were missing, made up the rules to be able to make characters without annoying little things like character classes, and we played.
Wow.
Now, those rules were objectively terrible, but I was hooked not only on role-playing as a fascinating thing that allowed me to take the kinds of pulp adventure stories I loved and have them go on forever instead of coming to the end of the book and that's it until someone releases another book, but also on being able to homebrew. So I was thinking in homebrew terms early on, right? Make my own campaign, make my own characters, make my own spells. It was not until later that I started to think in terms of this being a career. When I was an adult and married, I really wanted to get a subscription to Dragon Magazine. This would have been in the 90s. And my wife and I just could not afford one at the time. We were a very tight budget. And so my wife said to me, "Look, you do a lot of fascinating stuff with your game. Why don't you write an article for Dragon Magazine, and you can use the money they pay you for that article to buy the subscription?" So my entire career just started by trying to afford one magazine subscription. And this was back in the days where you actually sent a self-addressed stamped envelope with a physical letter that explained the things that you wanted to do. Dave Gross received that letter, and they'd said to put in four or five ideas, so I put in the three that I was absolutely certain he would want, and then threw in one or two more, just so I would have the full four or five ideas, and of course it was one of those other ideas he was interested in. So I started writing for the magazine, then I got really hooked on writing, so I wrote more and more and more for that magazine, and Pyramid Magazine, and submitted articles to a bunch of magazines that got accepted, but the magazines kept going bankrupt before they would publish the article.
So no pay for all that work then?
Well, so that was one article over and over and over.
Okay.
I would submit it to a magazine, they would accept it, then go bankrupt, so I'd figure, well, the rights are mine again, since they never published it and never paid me. I almost stopped submitting it just for fear that it was cursed. Eventually, Pyramid did in fact successfully publish it. It was a name article. So, in 1997, TSR/Wizards of the Coast did a writer's workshop for RPG writers, and I assumed that we could not afford it and that I couldn't go. And again, my wife said, "Look, you're making money, on this. If this is what you want to be your career, we can find a way to make you go. We're just going to have to do a lot of belt tightening." So we did, really, really tight. Like at the point that at one point our only grocery budget was, when we had friends over to game, my wife LJ would tell them that if they gave her $5, she'd give them a home-cooked meal. Since she's such a great cook, everyone would give her the $5. She would mass cook something, and then the leftovers were what we ate for the next week. But I went to the writer's workshop. I met a bunch of people there. I sent them thank you notes. And that put me on the radar so that when Wizards of the Coast hired in 2000, I got that job, much to my surprise. And then in 2001, 14 months later, I got laid off and became a full-time freelancer at the height of the D20 boom.
Yeah, you recently had a blog posting where you talked about the value of thank you notes. I think that was that's kind of interesting to see how memorable it made you in kind of the eyes of the folks at Wizards.
Yeah, I mean, my general advice for anyone who's trying to get hired is try to put your name in front of the people who could give you work in a positive light as often as possible. Mm-hmm. So if they have social media, you can get on their social media and just leave a little comment. Hey, that's a really neat article. Thank you. And then they see that comment and they see your name and they think, oh, that's a name I've seen before. And then when they see you apply for work later, if they're on the cusp, they're like, well, this person's been really nice. They've been helpful. But thank you notes, volunteering at conventions, if you go to conventions, positive feedback, negative feedback, even if it's polite, right? I don't like the direction you're going, and here are three reasons why, though I still support you and everything you do. That's just a great way to get your name out there, as well as, for that matter, doing your own stuff, right? If you're writing a blog post and you say, here's a blog post that I was inspired by, like if it's a D&D blog post, you can say that, you know, Jeremy Crawford or Dan Dillon or Chris Perkins inspired me to write this blog post. And then you can tag them and they're like, oh, I inspired this person and I can look at his writing. So I do think even just primitive thank you notes, because they are so rare, are a great way to set yourself a little bit of apart.
So you became a full-time freelancer at that point, and then where did you go from there?
So I was a full-time freelancer for 9 years, I think, from roughly 2001 to roughly 2010. And then Pathfinder had come along, and I had written an adventure for Super Genius Games, which was run by my friend Stan, with an exclamation point, and Hiram Savage, both of whom I'd met when I was working for Wizards of the Coast. And so I saw an opportunity to possibly do third-party publishing to support Pathfinder, but I only knew how to write. I did not know how to edit or do layout or do marketing or put together covers or have a business plan. But I knew that they did know how to do all those things because they'd come to me and they'd have me write this Call of Cthulhu adventure. So I approached them and said, hey, if I wrote things and took a cut of the profit rather than an upfront pay rate, can you all do editing and layout and everything else? And they thought it was an interesting idea. So I joined up with them. And about a year in, they approached me and said, hey, 90% of our income is now the stuff you are doing for us freelance. How would you like to become part owner of the company? And I agreed. And part of the deal was that I was only going to be able to become a partner if I got a Facebook and Twitter account, which I did not want to do. But they felt it was necessary to be able to market myself and to bring that benefit to the company. So I agreed because it was a way to get a third of a game company. And it was a tiny little game company. But that meant I was helping to make those ownership decisions. And then in 2012 or 2013, Super Genius was going a direction that wasn't a direction I wanted to go. So we had a conversation with Hiram Savage, who originally started it, and he bought me out and also bought Stan out at the same time and paid us with the publishing rights for the PDFs we'd written. So all that stuff I'd done that they had helped edit and lay out and do the covers and everything, I got the rights to. So I started Rogue Genius at the same time. At about that time, I was hired by Green Ronin to be a freelance developer for them, doing the Pathfinder edition of the Freeport role-playing game. And then just a year after that, the fourth time I applied for a job at Paizo, they hired me. So I went and worked at Paizo from 2014 until the middle of this year.
Interesting. So what was your initial role when you went to Paizo? You'd had kind of a varied experience as a writer, as an owner, you know, working a little bit in the publishing part.
So when I was applying, there were two jobs coming open, and one was a developer, specifically for the Pathfinder modules line, and one was as a designer for the core rulebook line. And I applied for both, obviously, because I'm not a dummy. And at one point, Eric Mona, the publisher, called me on the phone and said, look, I'm not saying that either of these jobs is yours, but if I came to you and said, you can have one of these two jobs, which one do you want? Which would you make your preference? And I told him developer. And there were two reasons for that. The first one was that I knew the developer job was going to get filled first. So if I told him developer now, and then I didn't get that job, I would have a second bite at the designer apple. Whereas if I said designer, they would pass me over for developer and I would only have one shot at this. Mm-hmm. That was the tactical consideration. But the other one was, I just didn't have nearly as much experience with adventures. I'd written two or three adventures. I'd never developed an adventure. And I considered, and still do, Paizo to be amongst the premier adventure creators in the entire RPG industry. So the idea of working with the people with that expertise and learning how to develop modules seemed like a really good career move for me. One of the reasons I wanted to work for Paizo is I think that they were some of the smartest and most talented creators in the industry. I still think that. And a lot of the people that were there at the time have moved on to do other things, sort of shows just how smart that they are. They've got lots of options. So I got that job and was the modules developer, and I was given the most complicated module Paizo has ever done, which was Plunder and Peril. And it was so complicated because it wasn't one adventure, it was three adventures written by three different authors, all of which you had to be able to play any two of the three. Also, it had to perfectly link in with the second part of the Skull and Shackles AP, so you could play AP adventure number one, skip number two, and play these three micro-adventures instead, and then move on to the third AP. And it had to perfectly match the plot line of the adventure card game they had just come out with Skull and Shackles. So it had to serve four different functions.
Wow, that's like a development nightmare.
Yes, it was. and I was pulling my hair out quite a bit. But we got it done, and it's a very popular module, and I learned a whole bunch. And at the end of that, instead of moving me on to the next module, they said, look, we want to hop you over to the player companion line to help Patrick Rennie, because that's a lot of work for one person to do it himself, and he's a little bit behind, and we cycle through who's helping him. So I hopped over, and I did that for a few. And then Patrick decided to move on. He's back there now, but he took a break from Paizo for a while. And I had just really taken to the player companion line. I did a better job of it. I did it faster. It was more enjoyable for me. So I went to them when it was announced that Patrick was leaving internally and said, hey, I would really like to put my hat in the ring for this job as opposed to the modules job. And I told Eric that, Eric Mona, and he said, great. Wes Schneider and I were thinking exactly the same thing. So unless you hear otherwise, assume that you've got that job. So I did that for a couple of years, and that was really interesting because it's a product a month. So I had, on any given month, I had to be looking at, okay, what do I have to write a blog post to boost for this month? What do I have to do previews for next month? What do I have to go over the editing for in 3 months? What do I have to do development for in 4 months? What do I have to take in and do art forwarders for in 5 months? And what do I need to outline and set up for writers that isn't coming out until 6 months? So you were always juggling six or seven projects at different stages of completion every single month. So, and I learned a lot about how the game industry works and about how game products work. I asked for and received at one point the sales numbers, for instance, for the player companion line. So I could, when I was pitching a year's worth of products, I could say, hey, this was really popular, this wasn't, and this is why I think we should do more of these. And that's just data that you can't get unless you're inside of a company. And obviously I can't talk about it because I'm under NDA for all that information, but it's still talking a lot about the industry. Then they decided to do Starfinder. And because I had worked on three editions of D20 Star Wars, and I had worked on the D20 Gamma World, and I'd worked on the D20 EverQuest, and obviously Pathfinder, I had a lot of experience with both science fiction and fantasy, and even some science fantasy settings. So I was brought on very early. I wasn't the first person brought on. Originally, it was James Sutter, who was the creative director, and then Rob McCreary, who is now the creative director, was brought on next. But I was the third person to be a regular person member of the team, and I did that up to the point that I left in July of this year.
Yeah, it's exciting, actually, to hear that you worked on the Gamma World D20 game. Growing up, that was like one of my favorite games. So that's kind of neat to hear.
Yeah, they had a Cryptic Alliances book. I wrote about half of that, which allowed me to take some crazy ideas that I had had for Gamma World, like in the 80s, and put them in an official Gamma World setting. One of which was, I remember very young, just being fascinated that there was a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Repair.
Right. Yes, I remember that book.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I was a big fan of that book. So for the Gamma World setting, I created Cyclers, which are a Zen lone knight bicycle religion who the book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Repair, is effectively their holy book. Because it's one of the two books that they got a bunch of copies of. So they are both big fans of independence and motorcycle maintenance, but also a very Zen philosophy. And I managed to make that an official Cryptic Alliance in that book.
Wow. That you know, that I'd like to see some of that stuff in Starfinder. So maybe we'll have to push somebody to do some third-party work in that area. That's really cool. That's really cool. So recently you've launched a new 52 and 52 gaming product. Can you tell us a little bit about this? What sounds like a pretty ambitious endeavor to me, but from your prior work, it actually sounds like a walk in the park. I don't know.
It is not a walk in the park. it is a lot of work, but so far it has been very well received, and I'm having a great time doing it. So what it is, I refer to it as the 52 and 52 program. It is for every week of 2020, we put out a new game product, and we have a preview PDF you can get free that tells you what all of the products are going to be, gives you a short blurb, in many cases already has at least temporary cover art. And each and every one of those products is released in four game systems. So we have different versions for Pathfinder First Edition, Pathfinder Second Edition, Starfinder, and 5e. So it's four products a week, every week, and you get all of it for buying into the program. By the time people are hearing this, the pre-order period will almost certainly be over. So it'll be $49.99 for 52 weeks of products. So it's less than a dollar per week. And that'll be 208 total products. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this for four game systems was that I know that there are a lot of people who are, for example, currently playing first edition Pathfinder who aren't sure if they want to move on to second edition. There are people that play like Starfinder and 5e and they can't be sure what they're going to want a product for. So I wanted to basically tell people, look, if you buy into this program, if you are playing any of these, which are among the four most popular RPGs out there right now, we will give you the same content for all four games automatically at no extra cost. And every month has a theme. We are working on runes this month, so we've already done a runecaster class for all four systems. We did the Sword of Kings, which is a runic weapon that has a different ability it grants you at every level through 20 levels of play, so it grows with you. And we just did Rune Magic, which allows people who aren't rune casters to access the Rune Magic system we created for the Runecaster class, and has yet more runes you can play with. And then later this, at the time of recording, later this week we'll be doing Soul Swords, which are weapons that the special ability that they give you depends on what your character is, because they speak to the energy of your soul. And we've got things planned out through the whole year, so it's super exciting. I'm on the hook for a year of work. That's 208 deadlines. part of my 450 deadlines I have already agreed to this year, since I also do a blog post 5 days a week at the moment.
Wow.
Because my Patreon supports that blog writing, so I can take some of my freelance time to write those blogs. There's a big blog post every Monday and then smaller ones Tuesday through Friday. But I'm very excited by 52 and 52. The other thing I'm really excited about is that I'm going to be able to get some feedback on what game systems fans of mine are actually playing. And it's very hard to get that kind of data. I was talking about how valuable data was earlier in this interview. Since all of this is done through the Open Game Store, they have been instrumental in putting this program together. I could not do this without them, which is why it's only available through them. They're a crucial part of the delivery mechanism. And John and Deborah Raist have been huge helps in making this work and pulling it together. I couldn't do it without their support. But people who sign up for notifications that, hey, you have new files, we can, in a few months, send them an email and say, hey, which of these books did you enjoy the most? Which game systems are you using the most? If we were to do this again next year, but we only did it for one game system, what game system would you want to see us support? And that's real-world data, not for the whole industry, but for people who are within my reach, who are buying products I write. And that's, for me, super useful input.
So, you know, it's interesting. So I subscribed as part of the pre-order, so I got it at the cheaper price. And one of the things I noticed is you get a weekly email, and you can download each file individually. One of the things I guess it would be interesting to track with the store is if people only download certain of the systems. you know, if you're only doing fifth edition, maybe that's the only one you download. So right. You might actually get some additional information from that.
Yep. I've talked to John Reist about that, and it's a thing that he is looking at. Whether or not he can get that information is sort of a proprietary to him kind of question. So I'll let him speak to whether or not he's going to put in the work and how practical it'll be. But you're right. It's absolutely a fascinating possibility that I'm really excited to see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a tremendous opportunity for me. This is a great way to really get into the nitty gritty of all four of these systems. Mm-hmm. I have written a ton of Starfinder and a ton of first edition Pathfinder before, but I have very limited experience with Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Of course, it's been out less than a year. And limited experience with 5e. I've done some stuff and I've played it, but I've not done a ton of design work for it. And while this is a huge amount of work, that amount of work of taking the same concept and presenting it four ways has already taught me a lot about the differences between these systems and their strengths and weaknesses and how each one of them approaches the same kinds of questions. And I think that is going to serve me in good stead as a game designer, both in the current environment, because it means that there are more game systems that I can say, yes, I'm competent to write in that work, but also in the future, because I understand how these different game systems tackle similar questions. And that can be useful for me for the rest of my career, that understanding of what is underneath the hood. How is this engine actually accomplishing things?
Yeah. So how much of the 52 and 52 have you already completed? I mean, I assume you didn't just say, oh, I'm going to start on this January 1st and get it going. I presume you already started some of these and had them in the works. And how much of it, like kind of percentage wise, do you still have to complete throughout the year, I guess?
I only came up with this idea in late October or early November. So I did not have a whole lot of time to ramp up.
Yeah.
Yes, I've started on a lot of projects, but nothing is complete until the week that it comes out or the week before. Because that allows me to take my very best understanding of these game systems for any final pass that something needs. Frequently, I get it written in one game system that it seems most native to and then let it sit for a bit as I approach another game systems. I carefully said when I was pitching this that I will write or develop every product, because I do have some freelancers approaching me who are experts in one or more of these game systems. And I am, as the money of this program allows for it, I'm interested in farming some of the first draft writing work out so I can see how other people tackle these questions. Then I'll develop it and adapt it to whatever game systems they can. This is going to be half my freelance time for the entire year of 2020, maybe 2/3 of my freelance time for 2020. Mm-hmm. I also put in a certain amount of time every week on Green Ronin. I put a certain amount of work every week on my blogs. That's one of the things that my Patreons get. I make videos periodically, for example. I try and do a few of those every week. And I've got other freelance commitments that I've agreed to. The more money this continues to make, the less I will have to worry about those other commitments. But If once the pre-order period is done, for example, if sales plummet, I still have to make those, but I will also have to take other freelance so I can pay the bills. So it's a gamble on my end, but I did not want to do this as a Kickstarter. I didn't want to hold it over people's heads. Hey, maybe you'll get this, maybe you won't. And this isn't a project I needed Kickstarter funding to make happen. I don't have a problem using Kickstarter or any crowdfunding as appropriate, but I don't think it's right for every project. This is one where I really wanted to be able to advertise for the whole year. Instead of having to advertise 52 products, I can advertise one product 52 times. And of course, each week when a new product comes out, I'll say, hey, here's this new thing we added. If you join the program now, you get all of this. That, of course, means that I risk saturating the people I can reach. But it also means that I'm doing something that sort of has never been done just this way before. And my hope is that that will cause, let's randomly say, podcasts to want to talk to me, get the word out, put out links. I've got some news pieces that have been picked up. Fans sometimes boost it. So it's a real experiment. And I'm always trying to experiment with how to make money as a game writer in the game industry, because it's hard. It's an incredibly tough grind. And there are really only two successful ways to be a full-time game designer in this industry. One is to find a full-time job, and preferably a full-time job that pays at least close to the median income of wherever you have to be to have that job. Those jobs are incredibly rare, and I had a full-time job with benefits, and I walked away from it. In fact, I've had it twice. Once I was showed out the door politely because they were downsizing. The other time I walked away. And the other is to have a other source of income, like a spouse or a inheritance that takes care of the gap. It is super hard to make a full-time living as a full-time freelancer. I've done it before. I did it for 14 years. But I would like to find a better way if possible.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like you're kind of experimenting with the business model, trying to put it, you know, on its head a little bit. And, you know, the value that you're getting here, even at the, you know, after the pre-sale price or the pre-order price, is still, you know, at $1 per week, that's like 25 cents then per, you know, per item that you're buying. And so that's, you know, that's super cheap. I mean, what can you get for 25 cents anymore, you know?
Yeah. So, and hopefully you'll get more value out of this than a single Jawbreaker or bubblegum.
Yeah, I actually think it's a little underpriced at that amount. So I'm hoping that that you're showing a new successful model, because I think it's an ambitious endeavor, but I'm hoping it does change things up. Because, you know, I've talked to some folks that are doing Kickstarters, and, you know, looking at all the RPGs that are trying to do Kickstarter campaigns, it's, you know, huge saturation there, and it's, you know, you have a limited amount of disposable income for people, and basically they're having to choose between things. So having something, a different way to make money for freelancers, I think is really worth exploring. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Thank you. I am too. And you know, if this is a huge hit, I might do the same thing next year, or I might do something a little more sedate. I might do a 52 and 52 that covers fewer game systems. But I have also had some freelancers approach me and say, hey, if you do it this next year, how would you feel about having someone do Savage Worlds adaptations of everything? Right. So if it's a big enough hit, I might partner with some people and say, hey, it's 52 and 52 in five game systems or six game systems.
No, I you know, at that point, if you get more people involved, you know, maybe you could do additional licensing. I mean, you could even maybe take it out and do it on your own rather than having to go through the publisher using. A lot of opportunities that you'd end up with as if the idea grows. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I will have a full year worth of data by the time we're done. And I mean, I won't be making a decision until we're through at least most of the year, because I expect, like regular sales, right, that there'll be good months and bad months. So I don't want to have a slump in February and go, oh, this is a disaster, we're never doing it again. If I'm committed to it for a full year, I'll be able to look back sometime in, you know, September, October, and say, okay, what do the numbers for everything look like? What is the feedback we've gotten from customers? What is the interest level when I mention it now? And see if we can, hopefully it will already be a success, and then see if we can tweak it to make it even more successful.
Yeah, right now I've seen a couple of reviewers kind of looking at the initial offerings, and I expect as you get further and further along, you'll see more of those, and that'll get more shares, get a little bit more coverage, and probably give you a better sense. Early on, it's kind of hard to tell, you know, how representative that's going to be of the whole year.
Yeah, so, absolutely. I mean, so. There's a sprint and then there's a marathon, and all I've proven right now is that I can do this as a sprint. Come August, we'll know whether or not this is a sustainable thing at a high level of quality that everyone will enjoy as a marathon. I believe it is. I did a product a week every week for 4 years under Super Genius and Rogue Genius. I oversaw releasing a 32-page product every month for Paizo for several years, while doing other freelance, sometimes hundreds of thousands of words of freelance over the course of the year on top of that. So I am of the belief that this is well within my grasp, but I certainly understand if other people want to see a little more proof before they are convinced it is within my grasp.
So now you've been freelancing for a while, you've worked for companies for a while. Kind of, what advice do you have for people that are interested in writing and developing for RPGs?
Well, the first piece of advice is know what it is you want. I originally was looking to make enough money to buy a magazine subscription. So if what you want is a side hustle or a hobby that pays you income, That is a totally different approach than saying, what I want is to make this my full-time job. Because there are people that can do this full-time, but even amongst the people that do it full-time, most of them have some sort of backup income stream. I am very much in the minority for not doing that. And a lot of people live very much on the edge, and that's stressful. And especially if you're young and hungry and you respond well to stress, I'm not going to tell you not to do it, but do consider what it is you want to be doing. After that, it's be prolific, be polite, and be engaged. There's a ever-growing community of fans of this material and creators of this material and producers of this material that give you opportunities to see how they do things, right? Even if you don't play 5e, you should be reading the 5e game rules and then reading Jeremy Crawford's Sage Advice and seeing what he and Dan Dillon have to say and what experimental stuff they put out on Unearthed Arcana. Because seeing that lets you see how someone else writes and develops material. Ron Lundeen, who's a developer for Paizo, has an awesome blog where he does things like writes an entire adventure path and goes through the process of writing it. Or he's an actual lawyer, and he has an article on his blog where he talks about the legal terms of freelancer contracts. There's a ton of information out there that you can find if you look into it. I spent a lot of time reading everything Robin Laws and Ken Height wrote when I was coming up, and I still, anytime I see their input, pay attention to it. A lot of companies have blogs. Green Ronin has a Ronin Roundtable almost every week where someone talks about something game industry related. I think all of that is a very important way to take input in. If you can, hook up with a community that will keep you motivated and that can look over stuff for you. I know a lot of people are part of the Freelance Forge, for example. There's also a group called the Werecabbages. I've worked with a group called the Four Horsemen. The point is that these are people that have banded together to be able to share their experiences and their thoughts. One of the reasons I joined the No Direction Beyond was that I think No Direction as a community is very much like what Dragon and Dungeon magazine used to be. It's a place where you can get editorials and new game content and how-to pieces where people who are being paid to write this stuff professionally in the industry, Luis Loza and Alex Agunas and Vanessa Hoskins, there are a bunch of people where they talk through their process, what they like, what they don't like, how they do things, and give you examples of it. And then on top of all of that, write. If what you want to do is write and develop, then write and develop. And if no one is paying you to write and develop right now, then get on Facebook or get on a WordPress site, make yourself a simple little blog, whatever it is, and write stuff. The barrier for entry is so low now. No, if you can't do your own layouts, you can't sell PDFs everywhere. But you can do your own blog posts, and not only will that get you in the habit, that writing habit, and give you experience, because even if you don't have a professional person giving you feedback, just writing more will give you a sense for how fast do you write, what turns of phrase works for you, how hard is it for you to finish a 5,000-word article, etc. But it also means that if you go to someone and you say, hey, I would like to do writing for you, and they say, well, have you written anything? You can say, well, here's my blog. You can see all of my writing samples. Mm-hmm. And there are still magazines that you can go to. I mean, there's still a digital form of Dragon. There's the Pathfinder fanzine, Pathfinder and Starfinder Wayfarer, which is a fan magazine, so it's not paid work, but it is professionally edited and illustrated. So I think it's a great experience to be part of that community.
Yeah, I just interviewed Tim Nightingale, actually, just an hour ago.
Yeah.
And so his interview, pretty extensive, talking about Wayfinder, will be coming on the week before this one comes out. So that's
good. So go back. If you haven't heard that interview with him, go back to what John Godek did with Tim Nightingale and listen to all of that. That is now part of my answer.
Yeah. So this is the big question here. So if you could wave a magic wand and change one thing in the gaming industry, what would it be?
Security for game industry professionals. There is not a lot of security. And part of that is that money thing we were talking about. Even people that have full-time jobs. Like, as of the time we're recording this, Fantasy Flight just laid off a bunch of people.
Right.
I got caught in a massive layoffs from a game company in 2000. A lot of game companies just don't exist anymore. Things that used to be big game companies, that people that worked there could depend on that job, those game companies tend not to last more than 5 or 10 years. The ones that are around longer than that are very much the exception. But also, not just financial security and like benefits, but also things like retirement and a secure community where you can not have to engage in toxic fandom, and where you can share your thoughts and feelings with other professionals who understand in a secure environment. So, I mean, I would almost literally say, if I could wave a magic wand, I would create a huge university-like compound where anyone could go and have their basic needs cared for and have professional support to look after them physically and mentally and psychologically, where they could just be free to create. I think there's a lot of awesome material that doesn't get made because, for example, if you are a part of a marginalized community, if you stand up and say, hey, I think there's a better way to do this than those people have, frequently you get shouted down and possibly even harassed for daring to suggest that you know better than people that might have worked on a game 20 years ago. That means your contribution is lost. And I think that is a terrible loss. And it's something I think diversity of voice and diversity of experience makes diverse games. And diverse games increases the chance that we get something new and awesome instead of just another Tolkien pastiche D20 fantasy heartbreaker.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's interesting seeing, you know, a lot of stuff that has been coming out of late about marginalized groups. And that's one of the things I've liked about Paizo, having done my interviews there, in that they really do try to reach out to diverse communities for both their in-house writers, but also their freelancers. And then they try to have some representation in the games they publish as well.
Yeah, I think Paizo does make an effort at that. And I absolutely want to give them credit for that. In many ways, they have done a better job than I have done in my personal publishing, for example. I also think, however, that we all need to, especially established groups, and I include myself in this, we all need to be looking at ways we can continue to do that work. Because the problem took decades and thousands of people and millions of dollars to create. So even a consistent minor effort is only going to make a minor difference. So I think we need to, as much as possible, all hold ourselves to as high a standard of reaching out and helping and looking for ways to make a more even playing field than exists now.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I actually have had previous interviews kind of mention similar topics as well. So it's good to hear it from you, somebody who I think is pretty well respected in the community. So I think it's great that you have that message.
But weirdly, you seem to be right.
So, Owen, what's next for you? What's coming down the road? You have a pretty ambitious year this year. Do you have any big plans after that?
I've got a bunch of stuff that's sort of on my might tackle it next list. I recently did a little preview of the idea of doing a 5e setting set in a magical fantasy version of the 1920s called Sorcerers and Speakeasies.
Right.
Which that received a fair amount of support, and I might play with that more. I continue to work on my really Wild West setting hack for Starfinder. I'm now the developer for Fantasy Age over at Green Ronin, so there will be big announcements coming out of that. They just aren't mine to tease or hint at yet, but there's some big stuff happening with that I'm super excited to get to be a part of. I also need to figure out what I am doing with little things like where I'm going to live. My wife and I moved to Evansville, Indiana, for a job opportunity that has not panned out, and we're not going to break our lease. So we're here for the rest of our lease's year regardless. And we have some lovely friends out here that we enjoy getting to see and who like having us around. But we have to decide, does it make sense to stay here for another lease? Do we want to try and buy a house here? Do we want to set down roots? Or, you know, do we want to try and make it back to the Pacific Northwest, which we love, but is incredibly expensive? Or is it time to go back to our home state of Oklahoma, where my wife and I both have family, we've got lifelong friends, we've got a big support network there. And it's not quite as cheap to live in as Evansville, Indiana, but it's a whole lot more livable than Redmond or anywhere else in the Pacific Northwest. So those decisions are going to eat up some of our time, and we will have to decide what we're doing. And regardless of what we decide, we have to plan around that. Because if we do move, for example, that'll be a big time disruption, and I need to make sure I've got enough weeks worth of 52 and 52 done that we don't end up way late on one just because we had to, and be that change apartments or change states, whatever it is, it'll take some time.
Well, that plus you have all the other freelance deadlines that, you know, those don't kind of go on hold when you're having to take care of real life things. So
yeah, they don't. At the moment, my hope is I will be able to bank a little money at the early part of the year so I can take a break from that stuff in the late part of the year so that I can just not have any deadlines other than my self-imposed ones, which is, you know, I've got 9 deadlines a week just to get the 4 52 and 52 products and the 5 blog posts done. So those aren't going to go away. But I can not do another adventure path or not do another section intro for a book or whatever, as long as I make that decision now-ish to not be taking deadlines that will happen then-ish.
All right. Well, Owen, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. I kind of selfishly hope that you end up back here in the Northwest, but I agree it's like way more expensive than the Midwest. You know, I used to live in Michigan, and it's like so much more expensive for what you get out here, and then the traffic is horrendous on top of it. So I don't blame you if you stay away. So
yeah, we'll have to do that unfortunate life calculus. And that's if I could wave my magic wand and create that university, if it was going to make it free to live there and take care of all your needs, I might plump it in the Pacific Northwest. But if my magic wand was not a really big magic wand, I wouldn't be able to afford to put it there even with genie magic. So,
no, for sure. I think I'd put it in Maui, but that's just kind of me. I like the weather in Maui a little bit better.
Yeah, but see, I'm not sure putting it in Maui is good for people to be creative because there's too many fun things to do outside in Maui. Right? It might be that I should put it in Nome, Alaska, because then no one will ever want to go outside.
Oh, yeah, been there, done that. No, I don't want to do that either. So, all right. Well, thanks a lot, Owen. I really appreciate it. And best of luck here as you're, with this these endeavors you have this year.
Thank you very much, John. I really appreciate you inviting me and having me along.